Leon Arcus, chapter 2. I think I've omitted something, yes. Before going to Raymond & Raymond, I worked for an antique firm called Douglas Curry. It was on 57th Street in New York, rather exclusive firm, based on the idea of a couple sales a day did it. And it worked entirely out of the social register. It's one of the outstanding firms of its day. In time, I've been made an honorary member of the ASID, that's the American Society of Interior Designers. And at the point of being made at the meeting when I received this, I told a story that my first day on a job, a woman came in and said, "That's a fine Hepplewhite piece, isn't it?" And I looked at the tag and said, "I think it's mahogany, madam." So, it's a true story. But actually, I learned at first hand American and European, and primarily English antique furniture, and that whole sort of thing. From there, when that closed up, I went to Raymond & Raymond and, as I said, finally went out to the fair. But running through all of this was meeting the man who had a great deal to do with my life from there on. His name was Stephan, S-T-E-P-H-A-N, Bourgeois, B-O-U-R-G-E-O-I-S. Stephan was married to one of the Isadora Duncan girls, one of the Isadorables, horrible phrase. And Maria Teresa. And I was handling her concerts, and that's how I met her husband, obviously. And Stephan had been an art dealer and been very prominent in the field of art. He had created the famous Van Horn collection up in Canada, and then went on to he collected the Lewison collection in New York, and had written a great deal. He was a great raconteur, in fact, one of the outstanding characters I've ever met in my entire life. Stephan and I hit it off very well, although, my heavens, there was an age differential here around 35 or 40 years. And I must say, this is a very wonderful, strong memory to me, because he sort of took me in as a son, almost, if you know what I mean. And it was through him, I think, more than anything, that I learned everything I know about art, or how to look at art. And I don't know how to describe that to you, because it was more osmosis than you can say something which has a factual base or anything of that nature. It was through him, too, that I met another man who also was in the same category I was in, although this chap was considerably older than I was, and also was Stefan's great friend. His name was Gordon Washburn. And I think I met Stefan, I guess when I was 18, 19, and met Gordon at that time. And, this is all to pay off in one way or another, and ultimately in my story.
When did you meet Gordon?
I met him probably when I was about 19 years old. So it'd be in around 1934, is that right? 19 and 15, yeah. But this all sort of involved in this whole tale. Let me go on. At any rate, I was out at the fair for 2 years, came back, and went back to Raymond & Raymond, sort of heading things there, then of course there was a thing called the war. I was walking down a street and ran into the brother of my doctor. My doctor, incidentally, was a chap I had known all the way from the years I was kid in Passaic. And his brother, incidentally, was a doctor too. And when I met David one day in the street, he was in uniform as a captain and was telling me about the work he was doing.
David?
Sachs, S-A-X-E. And he was involved in the medical material of the missions that the United States was sending abroad. And somebody said, well, what are you doing? And I said, at this moment, I'm wondering what I'm doing because I don't think it'll be too many years before we're in the war. Well, obviously we're in the war before the end of that year, but I went down there and signed up. As
the
personnel,
Army?
No, civilian. As personnel manager of Foley Brothers, Spencer, White, and Prentice, a project for southern Persia, Iran, if you wish, primary program was to create docks for shipping, roads for transportation, take over the railroads and modernize them so that in the event of war, we would have a method of providing supplies to Russia.
And your title was director?
Personnel director. I went over.
The name of that company again. It was a company.
It's a combined company. You know, these were the percentage plus operations. These were private corporations. Foley Brothers is rather famous. I think they built the, they were out of St. Paul. They built these Canadian Pacific, or one of them, I don't remember. They're one of the outstanding construction outfits. Spencer, White, and Prentice, I still see their name around. They were involved in deep construction. We killed this one, White. Where was it?
Spencer, White, and Prentice,
yeah.
And Foley Brothers.
Spencer, White,
about.
And Prentice was a deep foundation sort of thing, corporation. They would dig the... You'll find that these enormous foundations that go down into the earth for large construction enterprises are always have their name on it. Nevertheless, it was purely construction. I went over... Pearl Harbor came up, and there was a rerouting of ships and all. As a result, I was supposed to go over in November. I ended up going over in, Pearl Harbor was what year?
December 7th, 1941.
And so as a result, I sailed for Persia in March. I'll never forget the Normandy, you may recall, burned, and that rerouted all the traffic. I went over in a ship called the Aguilium, and that's not less said about it, the better. It's an incredible voyage, A-G-W-I-L-E-O-N. I got to Freetown, Sierra Leone, after, I didn't forget how many weeks at sea. We did the Atlantic at about 3 knots, and this is the time they were knocking boats out of the boats out of the Mediterranean left and right. Caribbean. It was a brutal period. We had a whole convoy. We couldn't keep up with them, and yet they had to go around us because we were the flagship. We had practically no protection except one little corvette. Every night the subs would come up and light up the whole sky with flares. And it was a wonderful trip, I must say. Incredible. We finally made it to Freetown and then promptly broke down and waited there for 30 days, rationed about a wine glass full of water. We had practically no food left. We had one meal a day. We had no water to wash with, no soap to wash with salt water.
I'm not going to go into the rest of the trip. We finally made it down to Cape Town. Most of us could not carry our bags off. We got there, spent fabulous time. I think I spent 2 months down there until we got another ship. I always have a great affection for Cape Town. And we got on a ship called the Tacliwa. I can't spell it for you. Pulled out when the rats began going over us while we were sleeping, and again we were out of food and there was not enough life-saving equipment. We literally coerced his coming back into shore, and first time in my life I think I've ever done anything like this, but I threw my bags over and followed them, and I didn't give a damn regardless of what was going to happen. We didn't have a chance if we were ever hit, and right outside of Cape Town the subs were out there taking pot shots at everything that was coming through. And there was, if you had a bloody chance, it was one thing, but if there wasn't, there was one life vest for every four men, and no rafts, nothing. And so we brought it back in. So I stayed some more at Cape Town and finally went out on a British troop ship. Got to Bombay, spent 10 days in the harbor there, and finally got over the Persian Gulf. I signed up for 9 months there. I stayed 4 years. Heavens, it was almost 9 months by the time I got there. It took me 161 days to get from New York to southern Iran. I lived at Ahvaz, Ahwaz, and we started the enormous task of building. The docks there are probably the strongest docks in the world. We had no wood. The only wood available was teak that came from India. And so these docks, which will never rot, were made of this incredibly incredible wood that took us ages to work with. We built miles of roads, and at that moment, as you probably know the situation, the old Shah, showing in a rather, the old Shah being pro-Axis, had to be gotten rid of. That was Shah Reza. So the Russians came in from the north and the British from the south, and met at Tehran and took over Iran with the present Shah as a sort of a dummy.
Very timely right now.
Yeah. Well, the funny thing is I went through the entire thing and I know a good deal is going on. Mm-hmm. The Americans had no right to be there. We did not have the right to put up an American flag. I'm not going to go through all of the experiences there. They're incredible. That's where I was hit by my first, I would say, the most devastating illness I ever had. I got amoebic dysentery there, and shortly after I was there. And for the rest, for the next 20 years, I was constantly battling, not dysentery, but a complete, change to my entire, let's phrase it better.
You weren't well for 20
years. Well, no, actually, my weight at that time, I went down to 131 and remained there for I don't know how long. It was years later I finally made it over 140. I can say I'm over 160 now, but it really was quite devastating. It changed my entire metabolism and everything. At any rate, it gave me one joy. I could eat everything. And constantly. But while there, I was offered a commission and accepted. I could have gone on to the real job, which was on the same outfit, asking if I wanted to go Rio de Janeiro, which was quite a temptation. But I must say, This was wartime. And having met the Russians, and I must say they were a driven force, and really seeing war in a very, very rough light, a light nobody's seen from the Western point of view, the decision was I decided to stay on and accept the commission. I ultimately became a captain.
In what, the Army?
I had no branch. I was headquarters, United States Army, or rather the Army of the United States. That's the difference.
So from a civilian
without any training whatsoever. That happens to be the nature of my entire life. I never had training for anything I ever did.
And what did you become, a major?
No, I became a captain. I could have remained at the end of the end. I could have remained on. They said if I stayed on for another 2 months, they'd make me a major. All I had to do was say yes, and I'd have gotten it. And I said, the hell with it. It was pointless.
Now, you were in charge of all the personnel then for these...
Well, that was under Foley Brothers. That was about 400 American engineers and about 2,000 natives, what commonly known as coolies.
And at the end, when you accepted this commission, you were
I went up to what is known as the Office of Technical Information, OTI, headed by Colonel Brown, Lawrence Brown, famous for creating the character as a public relations man of Elsie the Cow. It doesn't take very much to make any man famous in the Army. His name was Edward Fisher Brown. That's it. Yeah. All right. More important, I was brought in, and my first assignment was, you are in charge of three radio stations that are on their way from the United States. Get busy. Also, you better put us on the air right here. Well, this is all, by the way, a cover-up, because the OTI, as you may realize, is not a normal function of any Army Office of Technical Information. Rather, what it was we promised not to spy on the Russians, and they promised not to spy on us, which we probably both did, and RG2 was known as the OTI. That's about the story. And I will say they were much more successful than us, because I don't know of a single American G2 man that ever got beyond Tehran and went up to Russia. The Russians picked them right out. They knew every one of us.
And at this point you were stationed in Tehran?
Tehran. Avaz, by the way, is right near Dizful, which is the hottest place on Earth. And so I spent... wait a minute, I should tell you, I was commissioned in 43. I'd spent more than a full year with these Foley Brothers mentor apprentice. And... And I also want you to know that when I was a civilian, you know, we were only about 800 miles away from Stalingrad. And if the Germans broke through, there was no hope. The orders we got from America was just start walking eastward.
You're on your own, in other words.
Yep. And if you take a look at the map, you'll see what happens when you walk eastward towards India. You walk through an enormous desert. It'd be impossible. We were really goners, because if the Germans came through, being civilians, we were automatically spies and had every right by every convention to string us up. So that was it. And we were very grateful to Russians. I don't have to tell you that I have a tremendous respect for the Russian fighting men.
Well, we're at this point in the Army, and...
Army? I did the first broadcast from the United States, from Iran, directly to the United States. With Lily Pons and Andre Castellanos, and any time Andre comes through here, he still looks me up. I'll never forget those days.
What did he do?
He was conducting our orchestra. I did a lot of stuff of this nature. I created the fastest news service in the United States Army. When we got our three radio stations, I designed the one in Tehran as a large-scale one, and it was acknowledged as the model large-scale radio station built in the United States Army. I received, by the way, for that, the Bronze Star. I think I was about one of about three men who got any medals in the whole command. That's all I mean. We were not considered important. Commonly known as the FBI, the forgotten bastards in Iran. We were forgotten. And yet, it was an incredible task. Because it was the safe route to Russia. And most of the material they got. The material they got in the way of foods and tanks and everything else came through us. All their planes came up from Abadan where they were assembled and sent upward. I'm not going to go into the entire war structure other than to tell you that in the midst of all my just getting my radio stations on the air, we had to go off the air because the one in Tehran was chosen as the headquarters for the Joint American Chiefs of Staff for the Tehran Conference. Being a junior officer at that time, a first lieutenant, I had under me full colonels and everyone else because this, I was in charge of the American Joint Chiefs of Staff, and it was quite an exciting time. I met people like George Marshall, Bradley, both of whom I have tremendous regard for. I met a series of people like Admiral King, I wouldn't trust with a rowboat, and others. It's an sort of amazing sort of thing. You learn quite a bit about the nature of the people on top. But I do have a gigantic respect to this very day for Marshall, who I think was the real brains behind the entire American operation during the war. And for that matter, the others had a tremendous regard for him too. I met Stalin, Churchill, Roosevelt, Uncle Joe, as we called him. We thought it was a big joke walking through the embassy, the British embassy, where many of the meetings were held, because Winston Churchill's initials were on some of the doors, and I'll leave that to you. Churchill was a very sour man and was the least interesting. Roosevelt and Stalin got along very well. It's rather amusing because Stalin was a man of great personality, great projection. He was a small man, he was only about 5 feet tall. It was during this period, too, that I was also made head of all the photographic activities, so I had to learn photography, this whole thing. And I'm not going to go into the whole Iranian story because it ends too long, it would be itself a whole affair.
Deal with Churchill, Stalin, and Roosevelt?
I didn't have to deal with them, I just met them. And I will say that I was present at probably the most moving ceremony I ever been through in my entire life, which was the awarding of the Sword of Stalingrad by Churchill to Stalin. There was a dry hot eye in a house. I'm obviously omitting lots of things that I can't recall at this moment. What's the difference? It's getting too strong. I came back, ultimately, to the United States. 4 years is a long time out of your life, completely away from America. I never forget the reception we got. It took me years to get over it. I was troop commander coming up from Florida to Fort Dix. We were sidetracked for every crack train that was going down to Florida with people that were going there for application of God knows what. Our train was made of wooden benches. We had no toilet paper. We had no lights on in the train. And we were fed through one car that had a cauldron in the middle of it. And this was our return to America. There was not a man on my entire train who'd been overseas for less than 3 years. I'll just give you a little bit of the what was to ensue that from there on in. I came back to New York. I tried to go back to where I started. I asked no favors. I wanted nothing. I was offered shirts. I had no clothing. I was offered shirts at Weber and Heilbronner. I'll never forget this. Under the counter. You couldn't, in other words, go back to just being what you were. I had a job, and I couldn't go back. I didn't have to be in clothing. I was going back to Douglas Curry. They offered me a job. This time as running the place right under Curry. It was a bitter period because I couldn't even find a place to live. I lived in a hotel. I'll never forget the first hotel I came to New York. I did a silly thing that night. I killed all the cockroaches. Well, you know what's wrong with that? Cockroaches eat bed bugs. And this is my peregrination through New York from one place to another to try and survive and go on, be on a job. I went back to Curry. I spent about a year there. Again, a little bit dissatisfied. Stephen Bourgeois once made a crack about antiques, and he was terribly right. Antiques is a field where people can discover ancestors. It's not a place where it has nothing to do with my own roots at all. It's a completely foreign nonsense. At any rate, more and more I want to get back into art. And for a period I went back into concert management. Richard Dyer Bennett, I don't know if you know him, he was rather excellent. Tenor. He was a folk singer. I had known Burl Ives. I knew the whole bunch. And Dick, I thought, was the outstanding one. And Dick, at that time, was handled by Yurok. And Dick asked if I would become a sort of personal representative. At the same time, I might go further in this field. Again, I felt no desire to return. I stayed with it for a time. Got out, went, and suddenly Raymond Raymond opened up, and this time I not only came back to Raymond Raymond, but I ultimately, within a few months, bought the place with several other bigger interests. I don't have to tell you that. I couldn't afford to buy it.
Isn't that something that all these places where you originally held positions, you were always coming back to?
Don't you know life is a continuous sort of circle? I've always felt that of all things to sustain myself, why did I ever pick the arts? You'll never get rich. You'll always stay pretty broke. And why not get into something essential as making bread? But the point is, no matter what you do, you'll always keep returning. I was trying to get out of the arts, you see. At any rate...
When did you buy it?
Big pardon?
What year did you buy it?
It's very funny. Where are we? When's the end of the war? We're now in
47.
No, wait a minute. I'm back at Curry's. By the time I'm back at Raymond's, around 48. Wait a minute. I came out, yes. That's right. About 48, 49. One of those years. Returned to, and I became Vice President and General Operational Head, Raymond Raymond. See, it was a rather large enterprise. We had stores at that time in Los Angeles. Outlets in Los Angeles, San Francisco, one in Hartford, plus the large gallery in New York. And as I went along, I became more and more determined that the entire operation was wrong. And incidentally, I was right. And began going into original prints more and more instead of reproductions and knocking them out. Ultimately, I did have a problem because the largest stockholder was a young man who was of the, his name was Alfred Stern. His father, mother had broken, she was one of the, his mother's now Mrs. Max Askely. She was one of the Rosenwalds. And he's a kid who ran through his money before he was 21. And he was, his wife had ended up in an institution, and he wanted the device of getting out so he could remarry. He went through a lot of machinations, which were pretty rotten. And finally, I had him written out of the place. If he ever came in the gallery, he'd be forced to give me all my money back plus. I didn't want him around. And ultimately, I realized...